Good evening. My name's Nathan. If I haven't met you before, I'd love to meet you after the service. Right now, I have the joy and pleasure of reading from God's Word. We're going to be reading from John chapter 19, which is on page 755 of any of the Red Pew Bibles. Then Pilate took Jesus and had him flogged. The soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head. They clothed him in a purple robe and went up to him again and again, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they slapped him in the face. Once more, Pilate came out and said to the Jews gathered there, "Look, I am bringing him out to you to let you know that I find no basis for a charge against him." When Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe, Pilate said to them, "Here is the man." As soon as the chief priests and their officials saw him, they shouted, "Crucify, crucify." But Pilate answered, "You take him and crucify him. As for me, I find no basis for a charge against him." The Jewish leaders insisted, "We have a law, and according to that law, he must die, because he claimed to be the Son of God." When Pilate heard this, he was even more afraid, and he went back inside the palace. "Where do you come from?" he asked Jesus, but Jesus gave him no answer. "Do you refuse to speak to me?" Pilate said. "Don't you realize I have power either to free you or to crucify you?" Jesus answered, "You would have no power over me if it were not given to you from above. Therefore, the one who handed me over to you is guilty of a greater sin." From then on, Pilate tried to set Jesus free, but the Jewish leaders kept shouting, "If you let this man go, you are no friend of Caesar. Anyone who claims to be a king opposes Caesar." When Pilate heard this, he brought Jesus out and sat down on the judge's seat at a place known as the Stone Pavement, which in Aramaic is Gabbatha. It was the day of preparation of the Passover. It was about noon. "Here is your king," Pilate said to the Jews. But they shouted, "Take him away! Take him away! Crucify him!" "Shall I crucify your king?" Pilate asked. "We have no king but Caesar," the chief priests answered. Finally, Pilate handed him over to them to be crucified.
I'm going to keep that. Is that all right? Sometimes I use it, sometimes I don't. Hey, my name's Tom. Nice to meet you. If I haven't met you before, I'd love to do that afterwards. I've got one bad thing and two good things to discuss before we get stuck in to today. The bad thing, and there's a slide coming up on the screen for this, is that sometimes people have used this passage and read anti-Semitism into it. They've used it as a basis for expressing some kind of disgruntlement with the Jewish people more generally. Incredibly unhelpful. And against that, I just wanted to point you to Kevin DeYoung's words, which will pop up on the screen. He says, especially on the other side of the Holocaust, we want to make sure in reading the Gospels that we understand that there's no blanket denunciation of the Jews as a people. Next slide. In fact, you have to remember that John is a Jew, and he's writing this book most likely to other Jews, either those who are seeking to know more about Christ or who are young converts themselves. So there's no way to portray this book as anti-Semitic. Now, that's the first thing I wanted to just raise. That's a horrible thing. I want to move on to two wonderful things. The first one is a little birdie by the name of Instagram told me that some of the people from our church who are in a band are going to be playing a conference coming up soon, so we can throw that up on the screen. So this is the One Body Band. We don't own One Body. They're not like a Christchurch thing, but lots of them are part of Christchurch, so we love them heaps. They're going to be playing Spark Conference later in the year, so get around that. I'd love for this to be a place where we support the creative arts, where this is a place where creativity, fresh expressions, new things are always at the front of what we're doing. And to that end, the other good thing that I wanted to shout out was that actually we're going to do a spoken word piece tonight. Can you welcome up JJ? Give him a big round. Now, the reason that we're doing this is at the back end of last week's passage, there's this little moment about Barabbas. It reads like this. "It is your custom for me to release to you one prisoner at the time of the Passover. Do you want me to release the King of the Jews?" They shouted back, "No, not him. Give us Barabbas." Now, Barabbas had taken part in an uprising.
"Your name is cursed, and my name is praised. But it wasn't always this way. You're the prophesied one. The one that Micah predicted would from Bethlehem come. King David called you Lord 1,000 years before this day, which is why I find it odd that your name is cursed and my name is praised. You're the image bearer of Isaac who followed his father. The one Isaiah saw as a lamb led to the slaughter. The psalmist called you a stone rejected by the builders. And Jeremiah knew that you would be betrayed for 30 pieces of silver. Did you not know that this is how it would end? Did you not know that you would be betrayed by a friend? It's always a surprise when a friend backstabs us. I would know. Your name is Jesus. My name is Barabbas. Yes, I've heard about you. You're that teacher the Pharisees despise. You told the blind man to go in peace after you opened his eyes. You told him to go in peace after you opened up his eyes. You commanded the demons to come out. You healed the crippled and the deaf. You healed them from all of their afflictions, yet now here you stand. But if you're so powerful, then why are you on this tree? Why am I, a criminal on this hillside, standing free? Why didn't you speak up? Where was all of heaven's dissent? We all know my name is guilty and your name is innocent. Those should have been my robes. That should have been my chain, my robes. We all know your name is crucify now and my name is let him go. What? I don't know why your name is crucify him and my name is let him go. But I do know that I am guilty and you are not. Because those thorns should have been mine. That should have been my crown. It should have been my blood dripping from your brow. Those should have been my nails, my wrists in wretched perforation. Those should have been my desperate lungs gasping, resisting suffocation. That was my punishment. That was my wrath. That was my judgment on display on the cross. Do you see? My name is debt. But your name is paid. Who are you, Jesus, that you would die, sacrifice yourself for liars, for cheaters, for the rotten, for thieves? For a good man, one might die, but why then would you die for me? We all know your name is Jesus, but do you know my name is Barabbas? Why would you take my cross, brutal and rugged? It's because your name is love, and my name is beloved.
Hey, that was awesome, JJ. Thanks for blessing us in that way. Love that we can bring the creative arts to the front as we go. So that was the end of last week's passage with the great swap between Jesus and Barabbas. It's the gospel in miniature. It's where the innocent gets punished and the guilty, that's you and me, we go free. And what we find ourselves in today is the next little section, chapter 19, verse 1. If you've got a Bible, you can open them up. We're going to be talking about power because I think that is the lens through which all of this operates. In terms of power, you might have seen this power play recently. Anyone see the halftime show? This is Kendrick Lamar. He had the microphone. He's got some kind of a biff with another artist, Drake. And his power move was to bring out Drake's old girlfriend, Serena Williams, to perform in his show. What he's doing here is operating in power to put himself above another while the whole world watches. Can I take you back to your childhood as we think about power? This is one of my favorite childhood movies. It's all about power. This is Aladdin. You've got, on the one hand, the guy who we sympathize with, the guy who we get around. He's the street rat. He's the young guy. He's got nothing. That's Aladdin. He's up against Jafar, the power-hungry political guy who's got the king's ear. Jafar ultimately destroys himself in his pursuit of power. He goes for the biggest power he can possibly get to turn himself into a genie. In so doing, puts himself in that little bottle. What does Aladdin do with his power? He chooses to set the genie free. If all you get from tonight's sermon is Jesus kind of like Aladdin, you've totally nailed it. John chapter 19, verse 1, we're looking through the lens of power at every verse along the way. Then Pilate took Jesus and had him flogged. The soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head. Here's an artistic depiction of what that might have looked like. This is Dirk van Barbouren. It's called König mit den Dornenkrönen, which is just king with the crown of thorns. Obviously not a photo, but it does give you the sense of the kind of power that is being used here. This is straightforward brute force. This is physical power that Jesus is submitting himself to. Verse 2 and verse 3, they clothed him in a purple robe, that's royalty, and went up to him again and again saying, "Hail, King of the Jews," and they slapped him in the face. When you think about that slap, don't think about a little tap. Maybe an image a little bit like this might be something that you're familiar with. We're talking about power, we're talking about aggression, we're talking about violence, we're talking about the kind of power that is very easy to understand that Jesus is submitting himself to. Verse 4, here we go with Pilate exercising judicial power. Once more, Pilate came out and said to the Jews gathered there, "Look, I'm bringing him out to you to let you know that I find no basis for a charge against him." The background there is the religious people at that time have brought Jesus to them on a spiritual charge. They said he's committed blasphemy. Pilate doesn't care about that kind of stuff. He's there to represent the Roman Empire. He's interested in whether or not this guy has committed treason, whether or not this guy has claimed to be the king in opposition to Caesar. But last week in verse 36, Jesus said, "My kingdom's not of this world." And Pilate realizes this guy's not a threat. I find no basis for a charge against him. Verse 5, when Jesus came out wearing the robe of thorns, crown of thorns and the purple robe, Pilate said to them, "Here is the man." This is an artistic depiction of what it might have looked like. This is Ecce Homo from Antonio Cesare. You see all of the different people who are engaged in this moment. You notice here that the actual plan from Pilate was not so much to be vindictive towards Jesus necessarily. I think he's trying to get Jesus released. Here's the plan. He says all of these guys really want some kind of punishment for some kind of spiritual crime that this guy has committed. I know what I'll do. I'll have him flogged rather than executed. I'll present to them the man after he's been beaten up, and maybe they'll be satisfied with that. So he says, "Here is the man," in the hope that that is enough for them. Verse 6, but the crowd has its own kind of power. As soon as the chief priests and their officials saw him, they shouted, "Crucify, crucify." That's the Australian way of saying it. But Pilate answered, "You take him and crucify him. As for me, I find no basis for a charge against him." The whole way through, you can ask yourself, who actually has power in this moment? Who's making a power play? Who's trying to gain power? Because there's a very complex interplay of power sources happening. Adding to that, he brings in one more source of power. They bring in the law. And those of you who are going into law or you work with the written law already, you know that things that have already happened by precedent or things that have been legislated and written down, they have their own kind of power. What they do in this moment is they appeal to their religious law. Particularly, they're probably pointing back to Leviticus chapter 24, where it talks about blasphemy. So verse 7, the Jewish leaders insisted, "We have a law, and according to that law, he must die because he claimed to be the Son of God." Pause there for a second, leave power behind, and think about Jesus and who he is for a second here. Sometimes you hear the idea that Jesus was a pretty good dude. He had some pretty interesting things to say. I can add him in to those who I take life advice from. Maybe he can be my religious guru for 2025, and next year I'll try and find someone else to give me some fresh input. Here's the thing. They didn't crucify Jesus for having some interesting teachings. They didn't crucify Jesus for healing people. What did they crucify him for? Claiming to be the Son of God. Now, every week in this room, there are people still thinking through, do I want to stay Christian? Do I want to become Christian? Who do I actually think Jesus is? And you have some options at this point. I'm not going to try and argue you into any of them. Let me just present them. You could say, option one, this is all fabrication, myth, and legend. You could say he didn't actually claim to be the Son of God. That was just something that they kind of added on in the second and third centuries to make him seem like a bigger deal than he was. He never really claimed to be the Son of God. That's an option, legend. Option number two, maybe he was a lunatic. Maybe he straight up thought that he was divine, and like multiple people who are walking the earth today, he was entirely deluded. Maybe because they were pre-scientific, naive, maybe he was really charismatic. He tricked some people into following him, but ultimately, he was just a straight up lunatic. So option one, it's all legend. Option two, he's a lunatic. Number three, perhaps he's a liar. Perhaps he knows full well what he's doing. And he's actually just really good at manipulating people. He's really good at convincing you to follow him for his own personal agenda. Maybe he's lied to everyone at the time, but this is what he's being crucified for as his lie has caught up to him. Option one, maybe he's a legend, maybe lunatic, maybe liar. Here's the thing, if none of those options land for you and you start to see the holes in each of them, the option that remains is quite confronting, but probably the most reasonable. And that is he actually was. If you want to make it cute and start with L, you could say that he was the Lord. But this is the kind of question you've got to answer about Jesus. Who was he? And was he actually the Son of God? Let's resume our quest through power. We're having a look at verse 8. When Pilate heard this, he was even more afraid, and he went back inside the palace. "Where do you come from?" he asked Jesus, but Jesus gave him no answer. It might have looked a little bit something like this. This is James Tissot. It's held in the Brooklyn Museum. It's Jesus before Pilate. Who looks like they have all the power in this kind of a scene? Surely it's the guy with the clean white robes. He's seated. The people in the far right hand of the picture are ready to do whatever he says. And yet, if we actually think that Jesus is the Son of God, if we actually think that after all of this plays out, he's crucified, he actually is raised to life again, then we know that the most powerful man in this scene is actually the one who's doing the least. He's actually the chained guy allowing this all to happen. Listen to this interaction between the two. He said he asked Jesus, but he gave him no answer. What he's doing here is fulfilling Isaiah chapter 53, verse 7, among many other things. He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. He's led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth. Verse 10, "Do you refuse to speak to me?" Pilate said. "Don't you realize that I have power either to free you or to crucify you?" This is the explicit moment when power becomes the driving force of this entire interaction. Listen to Jesus' interaction. This is fascinating. Verse 11, Jesus answered, "You would have no power over me if it were not given to you from above. Therefore, the one who handed me over to you is guilty of a greater sin." In this moment, can you tune into the idea there that power is given? In one sense, we could say that all power is derivative, and any power which you have already in your life was, in one sense, given to you by another person, and in another sense, was given to you by God. In this particular moment, what Jesus is saying to Pilate is, hey, mate, you don't actually have any authority. The only authority you have is, firstly, the stuff that Caesar gave you when he put you in charge. And behind all of that, the God of the universe is actually the one who enables all power and sits beneath it. This raises a thorny doctrinal question. If you're into the deep Bible study kind of stuff, this is the moment to tune in. If you just came for the hangs afterwards, then I'll call you back in 60 seconds, right? This is the doctrine of compatibilism on display. You see the two things in those circles. Lots of the time, people choose one or the other. You say either God is sovereign, he's in charge of everything, that's just church talk, or our responsibility is real and my actions are actually worth something. But here's the thing. When you read the scriptures, if you want to sit under them rather than over them, you end up coming to the realization that these two things must be compatible. It must be possible for both of these things to be true. Because in the one sense, in the language of our passage here today, Pilate is just doing what God's plan always was. This is God's idea to let his son die for the sin of the world to bring us back to him. And Pilate is playing his role. At the same time, that does not mean that Pilate is just some bot, just like doing the thing. He is a responsible human agent. And here's the thing, in your life, both of these things are true as well. That God is sovereign and human action really matters. John chapter 19, verse 12. From then on, Pilate tried to set Jesus free. He tried to, but he couldn't because his power isn't really working for him. But the Jewish leaders kept shouting because there is power in a crowd. If you let this man go, you are no friend of Caesar. Anyone who claims to be a king opposes Caesar. Who are they saying is ultimately the one with power? They're saying the guy who's not even in that city at that time. They're saying Caesar is the one who ultimately is in control. And maybe you're given to this way of thinking about the world, that basically whoever controls the biggest army is the one who is in power in the world. That's the operating worldview for them. Verse 13, when Pilate heard this, he brought Jesus out and sat on the judge's seat at a place known as the stone pavement, which in Aramaic is Gabbatha. So apparently there's a thing called a judgment seat. And what he's doing is reaching for any kind of symbol, anything solid that can express or give him power. And he says, look, I'm sitting on the power seat because everything's getting out of control. And he's just trying to assert some level of control over the situation. He sits in the seat. Verse 14, it was the day of preparation of Passover. It was about noon. Here is your king, Pilate said to the Jews. Verse 15, but they shouted, take him away, take him away, crucify him. Shall I crucify your king? Pilate asked. We have no king but Caesar, the chief priest said. And this is where they've totally lost the plot. It might have looked a little bit something like this, if it's a helpful jog to your imagination. There's just people everywhere. There's a complex interplay of sources of power. Some people aren't even watching. But this is the Son of God on trial before the Roman official, before the religious officials, before the crowd who are kind of just there for they're not really sure why. This is a crazy scene, and it all ends up, verse 16, like this. Finally, Pilate handed him over to them to be crucified. I want to draw three points of application for us tonight. The first one is the most explicit place that the Bible goes in terms of applying Jesus' unjust trial. And that is that Jesus is our example. Jesus is our example. Let me show you that explicitly from 1 Peter chapter 2. It'll come up on the screen. If you suffer for doing good and you endure it, this is commendable before God. To this you were called because Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his steps. Now, we could preach an entire sermon on that, but let me just raise that for you for further study a little bit later. Can I raise a second point of application? The question is this: do you have power? You know, in a worldly sense, as people would perceive it. Are you a powerful person? It's been said that those who have power are often the most blind to the way power works. And sometimes I wonder whether in a socioeconomic area like Ku-ring-gai, That might be pretty obviously true of us. Many of us in the room already have power or will in the future rise to very significant heights of power. Some of us in the room are or will be CEOs, managers, employers. Some of us will have the power of a parent. Some of us will have the power of significant affluence. Some of us will have the power of position where we can shape other people's realities. So what are we going to do with power as potentially powerful people? One of the obvious things is to recognize that all power is ultimately derived. That we have received our power from another, probably realistically another person, as well as the God of the universe. But think about this for a second. What would it look like to use your power like Jesus used his? If it is true that the most powerful person in today's scene was Jesus, how did he use his power? How have you seen him outside of this passage, beyond this passage? What is Jesus' approach to power? Therefore, what is yours? Sometimes we forget to talk about Monday to Friday on Sunday. We forget that, you know, a lot of us, our regular reality is that we go to some job Monday to Friday. So let me make a brief comment, an idea about work. Most of us, if we work full-time, we're engaged in a company, an organization, an institution that deals in some sense with power, right? If you work in an optometry, you give people the power to see things. If you work for Centrelink, you redistribute power. If you work in a hospital, you help people to get power back when they've lost it. If you work as a teacher, you work with people, empowering them for the future. If you work in law, you work to kind of write the way that power is allowed to be used and not used. Here's the question. What would it look like for your Monday to Friday to guide your institution, your company, towards a helpful exercise of power? Not just propping up the share price of this power, not just making more for the company or making sure that it has longevity in and of itself, but would it be possible for you to harness whatever industry you're in to capture something of the way that Jesus related to power? That was incredibly broad because we represent such a wide range of people in the room today. Third and final piece of application is exactly the opposite. Because many of us, you say, hey, do I have power? Absolutely not. My dominant feeling right now is that I am powerless. The good news for you is that Jesus always sided with the powerless in his interactions. Many of us, and I don't say this lightly, many of us this week, this month, this year, recent memory, have suffered incredible amounts of injustice. Today we are studying a man who suffered a straight up unjust legal affair. Let me rehearse the big truths of the scriptures with you. One day, there will come a day where all power plays and all injustice will be done away with. But that place is not now. It's called the new heavens and the new earth, and we wait patiently, even though it hurts. But here's the amazing thing for right now, is that we can gain comfort from the fact that our God also suffered injustice. Our God knows exactly what it's like to sit in the place of the powerless. Band, you guys can come up because we're about to sing about this in just a second. Think about it this way. The most powerful being in the universe enters into the world. That's Jesus. He could have come, solved all of our problems and gone back. But he wouldn't know what it's like to be powerless if all he'd ever done is lean into his power. Here's what actually happened. The one who has power knows what it's like to be powerless. The one who has power used his power for your salvation. We're going to sing about that right now. Do you want to pray with me? God, we thank you so much. We recognize that you have power. We ask that you'd help us to live like it. We ask that other people would acknowledge it. We ask that you forgive us for when we've lived in another way. And we ask right now that you'd help us to glorify and honor and worship you as the ultimate powerful one. And everyone who agreed said, amen.